lot more convoluted. Is that pretty clear to you, Dick?
Yes, it is. And the answer is not quite as simple as you'd like it to be. When you're building a capacitor that consists of two plates, and if the spacing between the two plates is small compared to the width and length of each plate, in that particular situation, small spacing, large plates, you assume that the fringing capacitance is a minor effect, and therefore you've got a fairly simple calculation for how many picofarads is that capacitor. Once you've got a capacitor, and I live in the inch world, not the millimeter world, not the metric world, but there's an easy conversion between the two. If you go to the right reference data for radio engineers has it, there's a lot of websites on that. 0.225 A over T.
All right, Dick, we'll say 4 inches is the other plate, and the other one's 2 inches.
Yeah, let me finish this thought first. So if I've got two plates where I know how many square inches each plate is, that's the area, and I've got a spacing between the two plates that's small compared to the length and width of a plate, I can then plug into that formula. And if it was, I'll just assume now that each plate in my example has 1 square inch of area, and the distance between the two plates is a tenth of an inch. So now, A over T, area is 1, T is 0.1, therefore that ratio is 10. 0.225 times 10 is 2.25, if I got that right. So that capacitor I just described is 2.25 picofarads. So when the plates are equal in area, with a small spacing between the two, calculating the capacitance with a couple of percent of area, error follows that particular formula. Now, as I start increasing the distance between the two plates, so that now the spacing versus the length is not the same, or if I start changing the ratio of one plate compared to the other plate, now you've got fringing capacitance going on. In other words, the lines of equipotential, that's one way of putting it, it's almost as if you have water flowing out of one plate going toward the other plate. The water is not going to go straight from plate 1 to plate B. It's going to flow in a funny way all around things. The circulating other lines of force, so to speak, are also going to be giving you capacitance. And the capacitance you end up in the fringing requirement, in the fringing environment, is usually considerably greater picofarads than the simple calculation would indicate. So is there a nice simple formula that'll tell you how many picofarads you're going to get when you've got a big plate alongside of a small plate? You can assume that the small plate is a pair of small plates. That's the beginning of the calculation, and you know because of fringing, the real capacitance is going to be somewhat greater than that. That's one way of looking at it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But the exact degree of how much greater than a small plate comparison, how much greater, that's a tough one. There are times when the fringing capacitance can almost double the capacitance. The most extreme example I know of is a real puzzle that appeared in Electronic Design News magazine, about 10 years ago. The simple question was, what is the capacitance between the Earth and the Moon? Assuming you've got a wire going from the Moon down to the Earth, and between that wire and the Earth, a good earth ground, you measure the number of picofarads or microfarads or whatever. What is the capacitance between the two? You can start off, as I did, as many people did, with a simple calculation. The Moon has got 2,400 miles of diameter. Even though it's a sphere at a very long distance. Assume it's a simple disk, a flat disk of metal, 2,400 miles of diameter. Assume the Earth is a flat disk of 8,000 miles of diameter, and the distance between the two is roughly 240,000 miles. You come up with that particular capacitance rating, and by those areas and those distances, you'll come up with some number of picofarads. I've done that. The real answer is something like 10 times greater. Why? The answer is, in that particular scenario, the biggest capacitance is the universe, The moon is a large object in the middle of a universe. It has a certain amount of capacitance between the moon and the universe. The earth has a certain amount of capacitance between the moon and the universe. Let me drop. So by way of the universe, the moon and the earth are connected to each other by way of the universe. That's the indirect signal. The direct signal that flows between earth and moon is what you calculated with those areas. It turns out that the parallel signal to the universe dominates, and the answer becomes roughly 10 times bigger, opposite of common sense. So that's the most extreme example of fringing capacitance. That fringing capacitance between moon and universe and between earth and universe is the most dominant portion of that particular puzzle. And you do the calculation that way, and you come up with the right answer. I vaguely remember the answer was something like 1.2 microfarads, whereas you come up with some number of picofarads if you didn't include the universe. So fringing capacitance is not an easy calculation. It increases things, sometimes by a whole lot. In that example I just gave, it increased by something like 10 to 1. In your real-world environment, it's not going to be that big, but the calculation of how you do it, that's one of the things that you'll study in graduate-level electrical engineering, where you do some very fancy boundary layer, boundary value calculations for the way the fringing takes place. You establish first the way the lines of force between the two are going to take place, and then you integrate all of those lines of force. Not an easy process. I know I didn't give you an answer, but at least I told you some of what's involved. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
KC2WGB. No, great description. The only question left out of his element here is, how does that affect the Q, the charge of the capacitor? Is that going to respond to the fringe capacitance exactly the same as it would the regular plate capacitance?
Okay, Q is quality factor. Quality factor means that you take your real capacitor and you make a whole bunch of measurements with real good laboratory equipment. It might be a Q meter. And that allows you to come up with an equivalent circuit of your capacitor. The equivalent circuit consists of an ideal capacitor in series with some number of ohms of resistance. That's the equivalent circuit. And when you measure your real capacitor and you compare it to the calculation of that equivalent capacitor, the results will be the same. Okay. What's making the resistance in this particular environment? What's making the lack of Q? The resistance of the wiring connected to the plates, you know what that is. By way of your ohm meter, and you know how many gauge wire you're using, and it's made out of copper, and you know how many inches it is. That's one part of the calculation. The next part of it, you have to use the skin effect. Not all of the diameter of that wire that's the lead is doing your work at 14 megacycles. Because of the skin effect, only the top 10,000th of an inch of the copper is conducting the signal. So the real resistance at your RF frequency of your wiring is greater than you think it is. That's part of it. Second of all, if the dielectric between my two capacitors happened to be a certain piece of plastic, the plastic itself has a certain dielectric loss tension to it. It's got a certain RF loss characteristic that has to be accounted for. In the case of air, the nice thing about air as a dielectric for a capacitor is that it has a quality factor that's extremely high. The only thing that's better than air is vacuum. But air is so close electronically to vacuum that you can assume it's got efficiency of near 100%. So if your environment has nothing but air between the plates, then the dielectric loss is almost zero. Almost all of your loss is in the wiring in order to come up with that equivalent circuit. So again, you've got a
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Again, you've got to control the environment. If your capacitor plates are laying on the top of your wooden table, and part of the dielectric constant off to one side, so to speak, is the wood of your table, and some of that, some of those field lines of the electrostatic field are flowing through the wood of the table, and wood as a dielectric material is not very high in quality factor, the Q of your capacitor will go down when it sits on a wooden table as opposed to being suspended up in the air on a nice piece of Teflon rod, if you know what I mean. Not an exact answer, but at least it tells you some of the variables involved. Back to you, John, K2LAW.
Very good, Dick. I think this gentleman's going to get buried in this question now that he can go and research it and check out the elements that you spoke of. So I'll turn it back to you, and we'll get it over to Paul. And that's KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. By the way, you guys probably could figure out that I fell asleep just before the TechNet should have started. I was up kind of late last night, and so I was half asleep during the beginning. When I played back that recording, I'm going to be laughing at myself. Guarantee I was all mixed up. I was only half awake during the first 10 minutes. Paul, I've heard tell. I was going to do some searching on NASA.gov and JPL, NASA.gov, and Mars Science Laboratory or Curiosity, because I think I've heard a news report that they turned on the laser, and I'd love to know how many watts comes out of that laser. They turned on the laser, aimed at a rock, vaporized some rock material, looked at the spectrum that came out of it, and therefore analyzed that rock without even touching it, in theory. I know they have the ability to do that. So tell us some about what Curiosity has been doing. One of these days, you and I eventually found out how many watts comes out of the radioactive thermal electronic generator, roughly 110 watts, even though it's putting out 2,000 watts of nuclear heat that has to be dissipated. We're eventually going to find out how many watts is coming out of that laser. So what's the latest up on Mars, Paul? WS2N, our space expert, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that's the ChemCam experiment. 45 watts, 45, that's it. But it's done in such a short period of time. I forget how many nanoseconds. But it happens three times a second. So they blasted that rock, I guess 30 times, because they aim at it for about 10 seconds. So that's the number. And they picked a mundane looking rock, something that was had a kind of like a flat surface that was facing the rover. You know, this is really, you know, they're the first rock they want to shoot at. They don't want to miss. They want to make sure it's all perfect and all. It's not even really for science. Let's make sure everything works. That's the wattage on that. It's got a telescope looking at it. Let me drop it. The laser is invisible. The scenes that you see on TV, it looks like it's visible, but it's not. It's an invisible laser. And it brings the temperature up to some temperature. It's only molecules worth, but very high temperature, to the point where it creates a plasma. Now, if you were to shoot this thing on Earth with 14.7 pounds per square inch, it's the same thing would happen, but you wouldn't get as much of a plasma output as you do on Mars, because Mars only has less than one-tenth of the pressure that we have here. So, you know, when you hit something and it vaporizes, you get a bigger plume, I guess you would call it, from that type of a shot. And with the telescopic camera, they're able to photograph it, and it actually goes down. You know, you see the big head on that telescopic camera, but it really has fiber optics going back down into the body of the robot, Curiosity, and it has the spectrum analyzer down there. So I think it was 17th. I think they were going to do it either Friday or Saturday night. I haven't read that they actually have done it. Let me drop it.
I think I heard that they did do it, Paul. I think I heard that they did do it. And let me give you a quick interruption here or something. The laser pointers that we can legally buy, I own a green one. I used to own a red one. I still own a red one. They run 5 milliwatts maximum. 5 milliwatts was decided as the number which, if it's flashed into somebody's eye, most likely it will not create eye damage, although you should never look directly into a laser. But 5 milliwatts is almost eye-safe, used in a reasonable manner. Yes, if you use illegal purchases, you can buy handheld lasers up to 100 milliwatts, and you've got to be very careful with those. The 100 milliwatts one, you aim it at a balloon, it will burst the balloon at a ridiculous distance, or it'll light a match by just the heat it gives off when you aim it at the match. So 5 milliwatts is a safe level. 45 watts is 9,000 times greater in power. You aim that anywhere near where the signal bounces twice off of something and hits the guy in the eye, a 45-watt laser is likely to do damage. So that is a lethal. I mean, we as amateurs at ham radio frequencies think 45 watts is a low-power transmitter. In the laser world, 45 watts, and by my standards, is huge. 9,000 times above legal power of something that you can buy and put in your pocket and use in the real world. Back to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, and my guess is the focal point is probably extremely narrow compared to your laser, I would think. I mean, it's going down to the atomic level when it's hitting something. So with that, they'll be able to tell exactly what kind of material that they're looking at. It's a procedure that's really going to help them decide as they go along, because I think they could do, something like 10 samples every hour or two. They'll be able to say, okay, all of these rocks that we're zapping in this area, we're not interested in this, and then they're going to zap something else, and they're going to say, oh, that's really interesting. And then they'll be able to go over and drill into that rock, and then go through another process of putting it into the body of the rover, into either, you know, into the, what do they call it, the Kemmin experiment that's mounted inside the rover. There's a funnel there, and they'll be able to evaluate that, look at not only the exact minerals that are in there that the ChemCam can pick up, but in that body of the rover, they'll be able to tell the proportion, you know, how much of this or how much of that is in it. And they'll be able to do that with the drill. And they've got a scoop on board. They can put, you know, they can put fine grains of dirt into these test beds on the rover. They also have the SAM that's right next to it. Next to the Kemmin experiment, and that sort of does the same thing. But I think that one's strictly with the powders, where we could actually take grains of things like the size of a small baby aspirin. With the Kemmin experiment, with the SAM experiment, that's they're going to probably use powder. And definitely they can analyze the atmosphere. In particular, look for methane. You know, methane would be a sign that there could be life, although there might be a geological process going on. There is methane there, and they can detect that from the overhead satellites. And, they're wondering where all this methane is coming from. There might be biological life buried underneath the planet creating methane, because it should disappear in a couple hundred years. If it was a geological event, and from what they see, it's not a very geological live planet. It's pretty dead. This is WS2N. What else do you want to talk about? There's a million more different experiments on board, Dick. We could talk about where this thing is going. You want to hear that?
Yes, I do, but I'm first going to give you a couple of words on the back of the envelope calculation I just did. You asked a very interesting point, and that is focal point, as you called it. By the way, a 45-watt laser, by my standards, is a weapon. Now, let me give you an example of why I say that. First of all, I'm guessing that thing is capable of being aimed at a rock, let me pick a number, 10 feet away, and vaporizing a point on that rock. It's a weapon. It could burn a hole in an object, which could be a person's clothing, his hand, or whatever. But what really counts on a laser is how many watts and how big is the collimator. Now, let me show you the example that I did. I own a 5 milliwatt green laser, and there's a 30 mile an hour beaded screen speed limit sign near my house. I walk up to that sign and stand a couple of feet away from it and aim my laser at the sign. I get an extremely brilliant return, and if I'm using dark glasses, I can see that the dot created on the sign by my handheld laser is a little bit more than an eighth of an inch diameter when I'm a couple of feet away from the sign. Then I back away from the sign out in front of my house on a tripod. I set up this green pocket laser. I wrapped a rubber band around its button so that it stays on, and I aimed it at the sign. So now I'm 200 yards from that sign. And the laser is sitting on a tripod, and I walk over to the sign. 200 yards away, the green light hitting the sign is now a dot. I vaguely remember it's about 8 inches in diameter. So it makes an 8-inch diameter dot, maybe it's a 6-inch diameter dot, at 200 yards. So each one of these lasers, if you find the right data sheet, it'll tell you what the spreading factor is, so to speak. So at 200 yards, my tiny little laser beam spreads that far. It's about an 8-inch diameter circle. The next thing I did was to set up my 8-inch Cassegrain telescope right alongside of the tripod, 200 yards away. I aimed the laser through the eyepiece of the telescope after I focused the telescope on the sign. And now, through the telescope, acting as a collimator, that exact same handheld laser put a dot on that sign that was probably a quarter of an inch in diameter. So the normal 6-inch diameter dot that my handheld laser will give me at 200 yards became something like a quarter-inch diameter dot when I aimed it through the telescope. The telescope was acting as a collimator. So in other words, how big in diameter is the emitting...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
What counts is how big is the diameter of the emitting surface that's giving the laser light. Call that the diameter of your collimator. I'm using my telescope as a collimator. You use a big enough diameter collimator, properly focused, you get an extremely small dot, a very high power density, watts per square meter, at a long distance if you have a big enough emitter. That's the same thing as having a parabolic dish of larger diameter, you get more gain. Well, when you get more gain, you get less beam width. We're really talking about beam width. The optical people call it spreading factor or something like that, but I call it beam width of the antenna. So depending on how big is the actual emitting surface on Curiosity determines how much that dot spreads, and it probably has a variable focus to it. In the case of my telescope, I could change the focus control and change the size of the dot on the screen within limits. There's a certain dot size that I couldn't go below, but I could certainly defocus it and make it as wide as you like. So therefore, in theory, if they can change the focus, they can change the area that's being heated up by that laser. Back to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
When I first heard about this thing years ago, I thought there was going to be two different parts to this. I thought they were going to have, like, coming out of the mast, you know, some kind of a transmitter to transmit the laser, and then they were going to use this big telescopic camera. But it's all coming out of one. I was surprised to see that. It's coming out of the, like you said, they're using this telescope as a transmitter. You know, the laser comes flying out of that, hits the rock, and then that shuts off, and in a split second, the camera comes on, takes a picture of it, sends it down to the spectrometer, and that's where it gets, you know, it analyzes things. Well, this is happening three times a second. It's pretty amazing. And this rock was about 10 feet away. It has a range of 10 meters, so it's about a little over 30 feet. So if it's in with 20, let's say 25 feet, they're going to be comfortable shooting at anything with this laser. it's been the goal of this one guy, I don't remember his name, but saw an interview with him, and he said back in 2000 he came up with this, and it wasn't planned to go on to the Mir, the Mars exploration rovers. Let me drop it. Around that time, he thought, you know, it had basically been approved for Mars Science Laboratory. They didn't have any Curiosity at the time. And then around 2004, when the other rovers were launched, he was cut. Yeah, they cut him out of the deal. And he went to everybody he could. He knocked on everybody's doors. He eventually got a lot of people behind him to convince NASA that this was a very good idea. And it's going to turn out that way. Again, instead of like going up to each rock, drilling into each rock, and you can test at a distance. And if you're going to come up with, you know, 10 rocks that are basically the same, you're going to move on until you find something interesting. And some of the testing that they'll do, a lot of dust winds up on these rocks. They'll be able to test the outside, the dust material first, and that'll be blown away. And then they'll test the inside, and they could tell geologically, you know, what has happened over time. Is there hydrogen on the outside of that rock? There might have been a process going on. Let me drop it. It turns out I think this is going to be a very good experiment. It's going to save a lot of time, a lot of wasted time. So that's one detecting unit they have. The other one is on the end of the arm. That's the apex unit. And that one's, we talked about that last week. That's got the radiation. I think they use cesium or something coming out of the arm, and it hits the rock, and they can detect what that thing is made out of, you know, with the rock that it's examining is coming out. I think they call it the apex, APXS. That was the arm, the alpha particle, X-ray spectrometer. That's been on all the other rovers, too. So they got that detecting device. They got the ChemCam, that we were talking about. They've got the ChemMin. That's the detector in the body of the rover, and they also have the SAM device. You got the sample analyze on Mars or something like that. It's been for. So three very good units. Let me drop it. I don't remember if it was the SAM unit or I think it was the ChemCam unit, maybe both, that would possibly be able to detect their carbon and maybe even amino acids. So, you know, with this laser beam, you can eliminate all the stuff you don't want, then go over to what you do want, either use the scoop and put it into the testing beds, or you could use the drill and do the same thing, powderize it, and put it into the testing beds. With that and the atmosphere detection using the SAM, I mean, they've got filters on this thing and a vacuum pump that'll pull the air into the unit. They're going to be able to tell a lot of the chemistry that's on Mars with these units, plus other gadgets too. I mean, they'll know about water underneath the ground from the Russian DAN unit, EAN. It's really, you're starting to see why this thing costs $2.5 billion at WS2.
Yeah, that Russian DAN unit emits, I think it's 10 microsecond duration pulses, 10 of them per second, 1 million neutrons per pulse. Each one of those pulses goes into the ground, bounces off the hydrogen molecules that are in the ground material. Hydrogen is, you know, one of the constituents of water, H2O, and depending on how strong are the reflections and how fast are the reflections, can tell you how much hydrogen is there and how far away in the ground it is. So that's another very interesting experiment. Paul, to your knowledge, has Curiosity rolled on its wheels yet? Has it moved? And what's your guess as to how far it has moved? Or is it still sitting there checking out all of its instrumentation to make sure everything's working correctly? Back to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, they're going through all the testing of the equipment. I mean, even this ChemCam thing has a calibration element on the rover itself. You could shoot lasers into that to make sure, you know, this is right or that's right, or they're looking at this kind of material or that kind of material to re-verify if they have any doubts. So they have a lot of work to do with the calibration of all of this stuff. And within a week or two, probably less than 2 weeks, they'll probably, I think next week, they're going to actually roll it. Well, what they'll do first is they'll move all four wheels. You have six wheels. Four wheels are independently able to be steered. They're going to move them and eventually straighten them all out again, make sure they work. And then they're going to roll forward about 10 feet. They're going to actually make a Y turn, and then they're going to throw it in reverse, back up about 7 feet, and then go forward again. And that'll be the test, make sure all the wheels work, make sure they go forward, make sure they go backward, make sure they can do arcing turns and all of that. And then they're going to be on their way to the first site. They've already located the first site. It's going to be about 400 meters away with it, 1,200 feet or something like that. About length of maybe 4 foot ball field, you know, from where they are now. And they'll go over to this one site on the high rise camera. That's one of the acronyms for one of the cameras on board Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Let me drop it. That camera has detected an area not far from the rover now where three different geological areas look very interesting, and it's going to go rolling into that area, and that should take how long it could take. I mean, the rover could go at 1.7 inches per second, so it gives you an idea. It's going to take you probably better of 3 weeks just to get to this one spot, 3-4 weeks maybe. Plus, they're going to stop on the way, you know, and they're going to investigate this, investigate that. There's a couple of spots that they want to look at, in particular where the rocket engine blew some of the dust away. There's a slight outcropping there, and they might examine it. They're not going to use the scoop or anything for that, and they're not going to use the drill. The first thing they're going to use would be the scoop. When they do their first test, they want to put a fine powder into the test machine before they start putting any like pebbles in, you know. So that'll be the first location. The second location, looks like it's, I think, maybe 10 kilometers away, and that would be the foothills of this Mount Sharp that they've landed next to them. They'll go there, and then, who knows, maybe they'll spend a year investigating that. And one question was asked during one of the interviews, are they going to go look at, maybe the rocket pack or the anything else that might have landed there. And they're not going to drive up to any of it. They don't want to do that. It's not really part of the science mission. But if they get to a high spot and it's doable, they'll turn that camera around with the telescopic lens and zoom in on it and take pictures of it. You know, they know it's a real curiosity and a real cool thing to do. These are some of the comments I heard on one of the interviews. I think it was back last Friday. I heard it on... I heard a delayed report. So, very good interview with these guys that are setting up all these science, agendas, you would call it.
first place and we drop it. But a name, Glenville, which is G-L-E-N, you take the word Glenville, Glenig, something, I forget the pronunciation, but if you take this word and you reverse the word, it's a palindrome, you know, it's like radar, you know. So the reason they came up with this is they're going to leave it and then they're going to come back before they go to some other part of that mountain. So they're going to be visiting it twice, so they thought of this palindrome name to get this first location that they're going to. You might hear that on the news. Back to you, Dick. WS2X.
I found this site that gives you a comparison chart of Mars. It's called the Mars Fact Sheet, Mars-Earth Comparison, and gives you about 50 parameters comparing Mars to Earth. And it's got lots and lots of data, but the main thing that's missing there is how much is the orbit tilted. First of all, the plane of the orbit of Mars is 1.85 degrees tilted compared to the orbit of Earth. They're almost going in the exact same plane around the Sun. No problem there. I can't find how much is the axis of rotation of Mars tilted. That tells you how much the
degree is there.
What was that again, Paul?
I believe it's 25. I got that in the back of my head. 25. It's a little bit more than 23 and a half like we have.
Fantastic. Very close. Now, since the tilt of the orbit is 25 degrees and we're 23, that means the severity of their summer versus winter is almost identical to ours. And I think Curiosity is reasonably close to the equator. Therefore, my impression, Paul, and you're going to correct me on this one, is they're not going to experience much of a summer or winter. If you and I went on a vacation to a place that's very close to the equator on the Earth, the word summer and winter almost has no meaning at all. You've got almost the same weather all year round. And I think since Curiosity is fairly close to the equator, they're not going to experience any real winter. And even if they did, they could tolerate very nicely because they got this 2,000-watt heat generator that they can't turn off. They got this oven alongside of them there continuously. Am I correct on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
Yeah, that thing's going to run 24-7. No way to shut it off. The temperatures on Mars, this thing is located four degrees south of the equator. So it's, you know, for all purposes, it's on the equator. They're in a valley, bit of a valley, so they've experienced a little warmer temperatures there than they thought, and they confirmed that once they turned on the REMS, that's the rover environmental monitoring station. That's nothing but the weather system that was built by Spain. That was one of the international partners that contributed that. And that thing, you know, tests the weather and the wind and pressure. And that thing has been turned on, and they found out right now it's the warmest. You know, during the day it was. Got up to one degree Fahrenheit. So one guy even asked if it was centigrade or Fahrenheit. The guy says, 1 degree Fahrenheit. And you could get higher temperatures than that, depending on where the planet is located. You know, on that, the hottest day, I've read that you can get up to like maybe 50 degrees or more. So I wonder if it says that in and what you're reading there, the comparison to the highest temperatures.
Yeah, I forgot where that is, and I'm going to look that up in a minute. The word sea level on Mars has got a peculiar meaning. There ain't no sea. But if I talk about the average altitude of the land on Mars, and I call that mean sea level, and then I look at the crater that they're in. They're in kind of a crater, and I think there are a good number of fractions of a mile below sea level where they're located. So after they get finished, and it's a crater probably created by an impact of something a zillion years ago, and that allows them to see many layers of the of the subsurface material. It's a good place to go for that reason. But to climb back out of that that crater that they're in, if they want to travel a few miles away, I think they've got quite a bit of altitude to climb, because I think they're in kind of a pretty deep, very wide valley. Isn't that true? Do you happen to know how many feet below sea level they are, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
One of the reasons they chose Gale Crater is because it's very deep and very low in that area. It's not as dramatic, you know, with this cliff-like area that they call it Valles Marineris, the Grand Canyon of Mars, which is like a couple of thousand miles long, I think 3 or 4 miles deep, compared to our Grand Canyon, which is about 1 mile deep. This thing is actually below that, Valles Marineris. By the way, the Marineris, they named it because of the Marineris spacecraft, the early flyby mission in the 60s. That I got their name. It took pictures. The first thing to take, you know, pictures of that. So, although that would be an interesting place to get to, for the engineers, it would be a nightmare trying to land this thing through the canyon. So, but this area happens to be lower than that, according to what I heard. So, the mountain that they're looking up at, that's 3 miles, 3 miles high. They're not going to be going all the way up there, that's for sure. And then they're in the crater itself. It's a gradual ride up, but how far up? How far up to get out of that particular crater? I know they could do it, but they have eventual plans of doing that years from now. But don't know the depth between the rim of the crater and where the rover is. Let me drop it 1 second. Want to go near that because they could wind up in a shadow. They'd have to go all the way around. This thing could go right, you know, if there's a little, you know, a rock maybe 40 feet high or something, they would think nothing of riding past this thing. They don't have to worry about the loss of the sun. Electric generator. Hope I'm making it. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
Yes, Paul, we got 90% of it, not to worry. Okay, good material. Of all the material that Paul has just given us on the Curiosity Mars Science Laboratory, anybody else listening have any further questions before we leave this subject? Give me a call, that is a name right now, K2RIW.
Thank you.
the repeater at this time and running S2 at my house. I think you said he's running S2 at your house, John?
That's correct, Dick. S1, I'm sorry, S1.
It did show that color calibration target. It's right next to the other calibration things for the chem cam, you know, with the actual minerals on board. Just wanted to let you know about that, John. I did what you showed it.
So the calibration chart you're now talking about, Paul, is that on the upper deck of the rover?
It's on the upper deck. If you look at the back, I guess it would be the back, I would call it the passenger side. It's right below the UHF antenna. The UHF antenna looks like that big, looks like a gigantic oil filter. You know, not sure the diameter of it. But the dark-looking, meshy-looking thing, that's the UHF antenna, where the one-foot diameter high-gain antenna is located on what I would call the rear driver's side.
Question for Paul.
Go ahead, John.
The target they're looking at with that chem cam, is that the one they have the little magnets around to pick up the particles of metallic dust? The target they're looking at, is that one that has the magnets around it? It has magnets around the perimeter for the metallic dust?
Yeah, QSL, that's the one. They thought of everything. They don't want any of the iron dust that's floating around on Mars, which is, you know, to collect up. You know, and this time they really thought it out. The other one didn't have it. An opportunity. This thing has magnets surrounding it, pulling dust away from that area.
Is there a brush that can brush the magnetic particles off of that magnet when they want to, if it gets saturated, Paul? Go ahead.
No brush. No, it's just magnets. I guess they feel that's enough. You know, I mean, you know, you'd probably have to cover it maybe with, you know, a couple of inches of dust maybe before you saturate the magnets. They must have the spigot. No. And then, you know, even when it does get dust on it, it'll be like the other ones. A couple of breezes will come by, a dust devil will come by or whatever, and it'll probably clear it off in time. That's what happened with Spirit and Opportunity. They'd lose power. The panels would get covered with this dust. All of a sudden, it would clear up. It was shocked one time, and all of a sudden the power came back to, you know, 100%. And that's when they first realized that this was a regular thing on Mars. It's really not to worry about.
I think you're saying the wind was blowing the dust off of the solar cells on the...
Hit the rover, but you know, it had enough wind, enough air to blow it. Everything's so dry, you know, so just take a little whiff of a breeze. Don't forget, you could stand out there in 200 mile an hour winds. You know, if you were standing there with going 200 mile an hour, I mean, but the dust would blow off. You wouldn't blow over because the pressure is so low. You know. Take your helmet off. Back to you then.
Around. 1% of the atmospheric pressure, and temperatures that are almost always below freezing. So that's not the right place for a man. You remember that science fiction movie, Rocket Ship XM? All those guys were doing is wearing a gas mask as they were walking around on Mars. That was science fiction in the, I guess, the late 50s. We've come a long way since then. Back to you, Paul, KQLAW.
Yeah, yeah. Another one, Enemy Mine. That was good. Guy went there, and he eventually he was able to figure out he could take his helmet off. Oh, man. Good stuff. I remember the ones where they used to go to Venus. Land, no problem. Find all the Amazon women, no big deal. You know, you can't land the craft in less more than 20 minutes. The Russians did.
It's the Hot 97 on the Reggae Tip Live weekend. On the 21st, DJ Khaled.
I think Venus runs at a temperature high enough to melt lead. And so even normal electronics cannot tolerate those kind of temperatures continuously. So you have to have some kind of a cooling system on board that's only good for a short period of time. And after that period of time, you're no longer running your electronics. I guess any surface missions on Mars have always been some number of minutes of operation, and that's it. Isn't that sort of true, Paul? I mean, when the day comes that we build transistors out of diamond, and maybe those transistors can tolerate the 1,000 degrees centigrade, that'll be very different, but we haven't gotten there yet. WS2M, K2LAW.
Did you have a chance to research that?
Mars Polo landing. That's the one that they, was coming in close, and they think they had a mix-up between metric and the American standard. I still have doubts about that, but that was the one that crashed. Of course, land near the poles. And the other one was the Mars Climate Orbiter. I don't think that one crashed. I think that one skipped out, came into shallow. But officially, they really don't know. That might have crashed too. They haven't located them. I think they found signs of the Beagle 2. That was the European Space Agency, and that had a little rover on board. That didn't work out. That one crashed. I think they found signs of that one. Back to you, John.
Wondering about that. They mapped well Mars planet, and I didn't hear anything about them finding that. But if they wanted to, they could put dog biscuits in those satellites, and when they get lost, just send my dog up there. She'll find them. Back to you, Dick.
What's your dog's name, John?
Cookie.
So Cookie is good at finding dog biscuits or cookies. Okay. Wow. Yeah, I kept saying Mars, and I should have said Venus. 150 atmospheres is what I read in one of the reports, is the atmospheric pressure. And that, I think it's beyond crush depth for many of the submarines. I think the nuclear submarines cannot go to 150 atmospheres. And, I forget how many pounds per square inch the water pressure increases for each foot of depth of diving. You've done a lot of diving, John, so you probably got an answer on that one. 150 atmospheres, which is, 10 times 14 would be 140, 100 times would be 1,400. We're talking about something like 2,000 pounds per square inch, I think, is what we're talking about. And my guess is that's quite a few thousand feet of depth in the water. Is that true, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Well, a cubic foot of water weighs, I think, 72 pounds. Stack them up, that's a lot of weight. And you're right, I would never be able to take that.
Yeah. Matt, many of us know how many, I hear it quoted from time to time, each foot or each 10 feet you go down in the water, how much does the water pressure...
Connecting to N2KEJ repeater.
What was that again, Paul? How many pounds per foot?
0.5, one half per foot. So that's the rule of thumb. It's a point number. Like you said, we don't need three decimals.
If it's 0.5 pounds per foot, and so a half a pound per foot, 0.5. Yeah, half a pound per foot, and therefore 150 atmospheres is 150 times 14.7. Wow, that's a lot of feet. I gotta plug them into my calculator one of these days. But we're pretty sure that's beyond crush depth for most of the submarines except for the Trieste. Is that true?
Yeah, nothing could survive that. But the... And the basic way I remember that is vacuum. You know, it's 30 inches of vacuum. You know, so if you have 30 inches, roughly 15 feet. So, you know, what you have is, how can I put it? If you had 30 feet of water, you would need to pull 14.7, roughly 15 feet. 14 pounds per square inch to pull that water out of the hole, the vacuum, and then after that, then of course the vacuum doesn't work. That's, in other words, a vacuum. You could suck water out of the ground if you had a pipe 30 feet down on the, under the ground, if it was 31 feet, it wouldn't work.
Okay, you just hit it, Paul. Yes, air pressure is 29 in the fraction. Let's round it off to 30. So air pressure will support a column of water 30 feet. 150 times that is 4,500 feet. So therefore, if Venus has 150 atmospheres, it's equivalent to being 4,500 feet below the surface of the water. And I think a Trieste can do that, but almost all other submarines, I think, cannot tolerate that kind of depth. That's not the way you see it, Paul. WS2N, KHRAW.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of, I mean, per square inch, every, you know, 5,000 PSI on every little square inch, you know, it's unbelievable. Even if it was built as a sphere, it would have to be like a perfect sphere, probably like a foot thick.
What that really means is that you send a spacecraft to Venus, it's either got to be extremely sturdy if it's trying to keep the atmosphere out, otherwise it's going to get crushed, otherwise you've got to let the atmosphere in. But when you let the atmosphere in, you're letting in 900 degree, very dense, let's call it air, but I think it's quite acidic. So it's an acidic mixture, 900 degrees Fahrenheit at very high pressure. Other than that, it's a pretty nice place to be. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, I think it's is it sulfur dioxide? I believe the atmosphere is just like, well, you got carbon dioxide on Mars. You know, I think it's like 99% carbon dioxide. But on that place, you got, it's all caustic. It's not a fun place to visit. And Venus doesn't even have any moons to go to. At least Mars has two moons flying around.
Okay. Let's see if we're back. That guy is now S5 at my house, so he's heading east. Let's see now. The next thing I think we should be discussing is, oh, I have a
pic. Did you get that picture I sent you of the CN Tower?
With the lightning on it? I sure did. Multiple lightning bolts. I'm pretty sure that's a time exposure of, let's say, 10 minutes worth of that particular storm. I can't believe one bolt did all of that. I think you're looking at multiple lightning bolts in that picture. What do you think, Paul?
I believe you're right, Dick. It is a time exposure, but that same element happens.
I'm getting John on the input.
Yes, oh my, very loud. One of the things that I'd like to give you guys a couple of minutes on is a nuclear reaction and how difficult it is to do that. I mean, some of the things we've heard from time to time, like the Mr. Pons or Fleischmann. Pons and Fleischmann of University of Utah 20 years ago believed they had discovered cold fusion. They were using palladium elements and doing a electrolysis-like experiment where they were putting voltage between the two elements, producing oxygen and hydrogen, and the amount of oxygen and hydrogen they were producing in that electrolysis measurement, and the power they were putting in and the power they were getting back out, they thought they were beyond unity. And they thought it was cold fusion taking place. And now, with another way of looking at it, I think most people conclude that that's not very likely. To do a nuclear reaction, you've got to use particles that are moving at close to the speed of light. When you take a critical mass of uranium, and if the uranium is pure enough, and it's the right element, U-235 or U-238, and if you've got enough of it in one spot, then the spontaneous nuclear radiation, the spontaneous radioactivity, means that when one of those nucleuses decides to give off a particle, the particle it gives off is close to the speed of light, very high energy particle. And when that particle hits another nearby nuclear uranium atom, there is a slim possibility, if the accuracy of the aiming of that particle was just right, it could hit another nucleus and create instability of that nucleus and create another particle coming off of there. So one particle from atom number one hits atom number two. Maybe it gives off two particles of atom number two, and those two particles of atom number two hit some more atoms, and you got four and eight.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And you got four and eight, and with very simple mathematics, you think you've got a chain reaction. No way. It takes a hell of a lot more to do that. Here's my guess. I'm not a nuclear expert. I'm going to give it a guess, and you guys can correct me on this one if I'm wrong. But it's an aiming accuracy problem that creates critical mass. If I've got two uranium atoms side by side, and one is decaying, and the particle from the first one, I want it to hit the nucleus of the next one. The chances of hitting that nucleus is extremely small. Let me show you why. By the way, I'm going to use as an example a helium atom, because I know the specifics of the helium atom. When you go from helium up to uranium, yes, it's a much heavier atom. It's got a...